For this week's podcast, we touch on a topic that has been getting a lot of attention lately in the administration, in the news, on social media, that's water fluoridation. We wanted to dive deeper in this topic because we wanted to show our audience and show you how we look at topics and how do we dissect them to try to give you advice on what actionable information that you should take to your own life. And so it's important that when you hear a news story, whether it's online, in a newspaper, on a social media, or in the news around the administration making policy decisions, what's important to me and my team is that you have the tools to make the right decision for yourself. And so what we do is we dissect the science a bit here, and then we also dissect some of the claims being made in social media, and again, by the advisors who are advising the current administration. And so recently there's some studies that were cited, and we go through the studies. We go through a couple studies to try to understand how to evaluate a study, and then also how to take the information that the researchers are claiming and analyze, are their claims something that you should believe and support? Because unfortunately, all studies are not created equal. I hope you walk away with a better understanding of, again, how to evaluate literature, how to actually understand why people are saying what they're saying, and should you believe or should you agree with them or not. I want you to have some of the tools to understand that sometimes people are making claims on social media or beyond that do not represent the facts. I also hope you can understand this issue greater. I hope you can understand how myself as a scientist at heart evaluates these topics and then evaluates the science on how does it impact someone's health given the information that we have now. Well, I hope you enjoy. I hope you benefit from it. And I hope you make the right decision for yourself and your family, whatever that may be. We support you. enjoy and let us know what questions you have. Thank you. Hey, good morning.
How are you today?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. So I think what brings us here today is something that's been trending a lot in news, social media, the administration. So it seems like the current administration and health influencers are talking a lot of negative consequences about fluoride in drinking water. So I think it's best we jump right into it. What are your thoughts about fluoride? What is fluoride? Why is this a major issue that's occurring in media, administration, news, and everything today?
Well, try to unpackage this and you think about why is it a major issue? I'm not really sure. I mean, I could hypothesize why, and I don't come about a lot of good answers for that question. Why is it becoming so popular right now? You know, I look at a really popular podcaster. He had a podcast last year or the year before about this topic, about fluoride in water. And at that time, he stated that there are two current lawsuits happening. One in Buffalo, New York. People are suing the local government there for not fluoridating the water. The same exact time in California, people are suing the government for fluoridating the water. So it seems like a very strong opinionated topic where people have a lot of opinions on the opposite ends. And in my interaction with patients, most people aren't so polarized, right? But for some reason, the people who are anti-fluoride are quite loud, or they try to become loud around it. And I don't think they're doing it for the wrong reasons internally. I hope not. But what I would like to do is, with this topic and everything else that we make decisions around our health, is to inform ourselves the best we can to then make an opinion, dare I say opinion, or really a decision around action around something. So in medicine and health, we're trying to not fall into that rabbit hole of opinion or the bias of just self-understanding, right? The lowest form of evidence is like a questionnaire or your own memory in all forms of it. And just my concern around this topic is that people are making opinions that are strong and speaking to them like they're fact and misleading people, misleading the public and themselves possibly, and then making a decision that may be, you know, not exactly properly informed. Also around this topic, what I think the conversation isn't happening enough in the, dare I say, influencer population is the statement that the dose makes the poison. So as I was thinking about unpackaging this, and you know, this morning, I'm like, well, how do I get this started to try to understand how to verbalize how we approach this? And so I guess the best thing I came up with is thinking about alcohol and Tylenol and then fluoride and comparing them. So we can understand that alcohol and Tylenol are toxic to your body at any dose, right? To your liver is toxic at any dose. Now, that doesn't mean that there's an overall negative health consequence at a low dose. We find that if you have 1 to 2 drinks of alcohol per day, there is not a reduction in lifespan, right? So although you're introducing something toxic to your body at a very low dose, from what we can find, it's not affecting your overall how long you live. And there are not health consequences over that. Your body has systems to deal with the toxicity. Your liver is able to filter out the toxicity, and then you're able to not have a dramatic health effect because of it, or any health effect because of it. Same with Tylenol. Both of these things, at taking at an extremely large dose, will surpass your body's ability to deal with it, and it will become severely toxic and can lead to death. You can kill yourself with Tylenol. It's quite easy, right? Okay, so now we can go to how do I think about fluoride? And we're using the information that is found in the literature as to date. And fluoride, from what we can find at a low dose, can have a therapeutical benefit on your oral health and your systemic health by helping developing bones. And at a high dose can have a negative effect. So as I think about fluoride, like anything else, there is a therapeutical benefit at a low dose, according to literature right now. And yet at a high dose, there are some negative consequences. So as with everything, I think you have to weigh your susceptibility to disease and the therapeutics you're using around that. Okay. I have a clinical practice. That's my full-time job. I don't golf, so we do this. This is our hobby. And so I look at my patients, and there are a subset of patients that through their life, they are susceptible to decay, or as they age and their health changes, they become susceptible. These are people that can benefit from the use of fluoride. Children developing can benefit from fluoride. There's a population that we have in our practice that are not susceptible to decay. Those individuals may not require fluoride. So as we unpackage this, I would like people to not think of a black and white decision, fluoride this or no, yes or no, good or bad. Well, there's more factors to weigh into. It's a multifactorial approach as assessing any situation as per what level is healthy, what level is unhealthy, what level are you exposed to by your activities, by your surroundings, by what you eat and drink and what you do for your oral home care, and what is your susceptibility around it in combination of your exposure. And then we can make an informed decision on how to act at this point in time. And we're also going to be ready to change our approach and change our decision as more information comes out. So more information might come out that reinforces our current beliefs, our beliefs are decided by the information available to us. I'd like to think that we can make decisions empirically on objective information instead of making subjective decisions upon fear of something. I mean, this happens every week in our clinical practice with radiographs, right? It's something you can't see. It's hard to measure because you can't weigh it. I mean, you could keep track of how much you're getting. None of our patients really do that. But yet I do have a subset of population of patients that are quite nervous about radiographs and give us a lot of resistance when we suggest them. Ultimately, I think we live in a place in the world where you can make the decision yourself. It's a very simple thing. If you want to avoid fluoride, it's a very simple thing to avoid. And we'll talk about some options that we have for people and for our patients that try to avoid fluoride. And I think that it's an individual decision on your action. That's the beauty of how we live our life. But ultimately, I think your decision can be made because you are afraid of fluoride, not because of what some influencer said. And you can kind of make a decision around that.
With the current conversations of removing fluoride from our drinking water, what is the safe dosage amount of fluoride in drinking water right now?
Right now, the suggested amount is 0.7 to 1 milligram per milliliter in drinking water. There are some websites you can look up on what your drinking water is near you. You can contact your local town or municipality, whoever handling the water, to see what they're adding to it, if it's added. What we're finding is that level of water, when it's in your drinking water, are on the population, about a 25% decrease in tooth decay in those populations. And that's where that number was picked upon. This kind of started back in the 1940s. Michigan introduced a public health initiative to introduce it to water and then evaluate if it helped or not. It really started an observation earlier in the century where there was observed that individuals that had these white spots on their teeth, fluorosis, extra amounts of fluoride on their teeth, did not suffer from tooth decay. So it's kind of funny that sometimes we treat children of dentists. And in my dental school class, we had some classmates who were children of dentists, and invariably, they almost always have some fluorosis on their teeth. Like their parents made sure they got plenty of fluoride. Luckily, none of them ever have tooth decay. Negative consequences, fluorosis of your teeth have a little white spot. Some have it worse than others. And there was an observation, and this kind of started the belief around fluoride, the understanding of it. And then later in the century, like I said, in the 1940s, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, there was an experiment to see if it would help. And they found a 60% reduction in tooth decay because of this. And that really just started the entire initiative. And so the CDC, they recommend 0.7 milligrams per milliliter of water. And it used to be a little higher range about 20 years ago, 10 years ago, and then kind of got lowered a little bit, probably from some of this talks that have been ruminating around. It's also interesting to find that, you know, some locations just have more fluoride in their water naturally, because fluoride is a naturally occurring element. Of course, it's in our food and our body, just without us adding it.
Since fluoride is proven to show reduction in tooth decay, how does it work? Like, what is the process? Can you walk me through it?
You know, we recorded in a previous podcast about fluoride in our caries podcast, but it's worth dipping in here just to get a little understanding of what the process is, right? So your tooth is made of crystalline substance, calcium phosphate hydroxyl groups, right? Calcium phosphate. And it's a crystalline structure known as hydroxyapatite, right? You see that now in natural toothpaste. And so that's the crystalline structure. As you eat, drink, as acids introduced to your mouth, mechanical forces, the crystalline structure starts to break apart. And in your saliva are natural minerals that can help to replenish your tooth. And so there's this constant play of breaking down and rebuilding, breaking down and rebuilding. Fluoride can help accelerate the rebuilding in a stronger manner. So fluoride will bond to the calcium phosphate in replace of the hydroxyl group, and it'll bind to the crystalline structure like 10 times stronger than the hydroxyapatite. So you have fluoroapatite bonding in place of hydroxyapatite, and it's a stronger molecule. So in sense, it's making your teeth stronger than they were before when in the presence of fluoride. That's the basic mechanism which fluoride is working. You also get some secondary benefits of it, that it actually disrupts the metabolism of bacteria by inhibiting the enzymes of the bacteria. You get the hardening of the tooth, so the bacteria itself can't adhere as easily because the tooth is slicker to the actual bacteria. And it actually can inhibit the process in which the bacteria can metabolize carbohydrates and produce acid. So it's working from a multifactorial approach here, and you're getting a couple different benefits from it. And that's why fluoride was, dare I say, a simple, very effective, compared to not using it, cheap way of helping to deal with decay, tooth decay, and lowering the rate of it.
So what is the appropriate amount of fluoride amongst different age groups?
Well, we'll put a chart in the show notes, and it ranges per age, right? And it's correlated more for weight, of course. So as you're younger, of course, we're recommending less. And as you get older, there's more. I think it's important if you're a person who's concerned about tooth decay, bone development, and also the toxicity of fluoride, you can very easily see where your children or yourself are in the chart, see how much you'd be exposed to, and you can almost monitor your exposure quite easily. In a quarter teaspoon of toothpaste, you have about 1.3 milligrams in the standard toothpaste. So if you were to brush two or three times a day, you might get all that you need in that exposure. And if you're worried about tooth decay and also fluoride exposure, we tell our patients, use a fluoride toothpaste and then just rinse well afterwards, so you're not getting systemic involvement, right? For yourself, your children. Your children are old enough, right? The 2 and 3 year old is going to eat some of that toothpaste. So you might, if you're concerned, want to either make sure you're putting the appropriate amount of toothpaste on the toothbrush, and or alternating from a fluoride toothpaste to versus a nano hydroxyapatite toothpaste, and alternating that also just to lower the dose if you're concerned. on top of that, you could also think about your exposure when you're at your dentist. Pediatric dentists might do fluoride treatments on children. We do fluoride treatments on our patients and typically using a 5% varnish treatment, which is the most effective way to administer fluoride and have an effect of reducing tooth decay. So you can quantify it if you want and if you're concerned. I notice that most people aren't. Maybe most more people who are listening to a podcast like this are. So if that's you, great. It's an easy thing to measure the dose and to track how much you're being exposed to either on a daily basis or monthly, annually. In terms of drinking water, you can simply filter all of your water at home through various methods, drinking bottled water, and then exposing yourself through your oral hygiene products and or at your dental visits.
So we find that there are other ways that people are exposed to fluoride. So what are some common ways that they can be exposed to it?
This is part of the funny part of the conversation, right? What I'm looking at is when we're preparing for something like this, going through I'm going on a deep dive of like influencers talking about it. And there's commonly they're not even talking about this part, right? That you're exposed to fluoride commonly through the food and beverages that we enjoy, right? Tea alone can range from 0.3 to 6.5 milligrams per liter of fluoride. Brewed tea specifically has a very high fluoride content. And so I think to treat fluoride like it's something, a mysterious thing that we're adding, a medicinal that we're, you know, very afraid of or very toxic is not exactly appropriate when it's a naturally occurring and we're ingesting it regularly in the things that we enjoy that are considered healthy.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about fluoride in drinking water. Like, what is the components of fluoride in our average drinking water?
In 2018, there's a Cochrane Review cross-section study of looking at fluoride in community water and tooth decay, right? It found that 75% or more drinking water contained at least 0.7 milligrams per liter of fluoride. That showed a 30% reduction of caries in primary teeth, right? So in developing children, their baby teeth, and a 12% reduction in permanent teeth. As we age, our susceptibility changes. So also the quality and quantity of food and how you eat changes, milk versus soft diet versus actual food and eating in meals versus snacking. And that all has a greater effect of tooth decay. There's a few other studies that support the reduction in tooth decay. Australia did a couple of studies. In a study of almost 4,000 individuals, it showed that there's a reduction of, again, 11 to 12% of tooth decay. And then they did another study, a separate study. These are all quoted in our show notes, about 900 individuals. This was in the military. And they found a 24% lower incidence of tooth decay when the fluoride ranged from 0.5 to 1 milligram per liter. So we can support the reduction in tooth decay in the literature and through studies that have been done consistently. And so I would stress that if you are an individual who is susceptible to tooth decay, you should consider your exposure of fluoride. If you are someone who is not susceptible to tooth decay, then this may be a null point. It may be not even worth thinking about. Drink filtered water. You can use a non-fluoride toothpaste and keep moving. So with that said, you know, the company line is that we in our practice and the dental profession as a whole supports the use of fluoride. We also can say that you can be exposed to too much fluoride. We can agree upon that. That is part of the conversation. To say that on a post that fluoride is a neurotoxin, avoid it at all costs, I don't think is appropriate again. But let's talk about how much is too much and how to be careful and what can be some of the problems when you are be exposed to too high of a rate of fluoride. So the simple thing we spoke about previously is fluorosis, right? White spots in your teeth. It's more of a cosmetic issue. It is not an issue in terms of health. As we stated before, people who have fluorosis in their teeth have a lower rate of caries. So it actually makes your teeth stronger. Although fluorosis can decrease the bond strength of a dental restoration. So there is some negative aesthetic consequences. And then just chemically, the tooth surface is so strong, the fluoride actually can prevent the composite restoration polymerizing completely. So you do have a downside if your teeth have too much fluoride in them. In terms of if you needed to get veneers or a filling, chances are you won't even need the filling because you'll be less susceptible to tooth decay. Typically, this is happening when you're exposed to 4 milligrams per liter or higher, right? This is 6 times higher than in almost all the water in our country, at least. The other thing that can happen, aside from your teeth, is skeletal fluorosis. So fluoride can strengthen the long bones in your body, but if there's too much fluoride, it can actually lead to your joints being stiff, painful joints, weak bones, and muscle loss and nerve problems. And again, the upper limit changes as you age. When you're first born, it could be 0.7 milligrams per liter for the first 6 months of your life. That's tap water, right? But then once you're past that point, it incrementally increases up till about 9 years old. And at 9, the upper limit where we're considering the problem starts, about 10 milligrams per liter, which is almost a hard number to get to in the current environment of the average person. So right now, where there's a lot of attention being given is that with increased fluoride exposure, some people say any, there's a reduction in IQ. That's where there is some findings in the literature, but again, the dosage is very high and almost hard to obtain to get an actual movement on the IQ. There was a study out of Japan, and this study was one of the landmark study noting that this can happen. These individuals were exposed to 11 milligrams per liter in the water, partially because of the environment, right? There's some places in the world, specifically China, that their natural drinking water has an extremely high fluoride concentration. And so the study that kind of started this conversation had an extremely high exposure. And I just want to reiterate, the dose makes the poison. The dose makes the poison here. So most places in our country, at least, it's extremely hard to get to that number. When we were prepping for this, and last night, I saw this dentist and it infuriated me. He's like in a pharmacy holding like two tubes of toothpaste. And he's like, the fluoride in this toothpaste can kill your children. It's like, and so, you know, if someone's posting things like that, or you're seeing that, it's probably worth trying to understand if they're just trying to get you to click on their post to try to get traction, or if they're actually genuinely trying to help you as an individual. Somebody walking around a pharmacy yelling about products that are sold and making claims that you can't even back up through medical literature, what is the ammunition for this person to do that? They're trying to gain followers or get likes or get people, just get more traction and grow their brand. I can't think that they're trying to actually help somebody. I don't mean to, you know, fire a shot here, but I just feel it's a little irresponsible as a healthcare professional to make claims that are not have any medical basis. There's also an article that was put out by the Archives of Toxicology in 2020. Again, we'll link to the study also in our show notes. In conclusion, based on the totality of current available scientific evidence, the present review does not support the presumption that fluoride should be assessed as a human development neurotoxin at the current exposure levels in Europe. So this is a European study, and based off of their findings, there was not any harmful evidence that's in the literature supporting this belief. So with that, there's another study we're going to talk about right now. And in our research for this article, there is an individual that is consulting to the current administration. And this person posted that fluoride is, you know, a neurotoxin and will lower the IQ of your children. And they posted it. And they posted an article that was quoted in JAMA, the article of the American Medical Association. And so I want to go through that article with everybody. Their conclusion was, this cohort study found prenatal fluoride exposure was associated with risk for neurobehavioral problems amongst children. So the individual is posting something on social media saying, fluoride is affecting your children and making them behave poorly, something like that. And so I'd like you to pause when you see something like this. And I would love if you could take a step back and try to understand how they came upon this conclusion. So how was the study done and how are they making a conclusion? And I think that's a really important thing to ask yourself. There was a study last year that came upon about xylitol and how bad it was. If you have xylitol, you'll be cardiovascular problems. Well, what they were talking about was if you drink xylitol beverages and you're exposed at a rate 30 times higher than if you have a xylitol mint. Again, the dose makes a poison here. So in this study that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association, there were a few limitations from my position. What they did was they took women when they were pregnant, and they did a single spot maternal urinary analysis. Ascertain how much fluoride you're being exposed to. Maternal urinary fluoride is considered reliable and the best overall fluoride measurement of your exposure during pregnancy. It's not perfect. There are some problems, but it's the gold standard right now. It's not the gold standard when you're not coached to have the test done to you. So what I mean by that, if you brush your teeth and don't rinse properly and are dehydrated and do the test, you will have a higher level of fluoride in your urine than if you take the test hours after you've brushed your teeth or well hydrated. And so the other thing is that I haven't been pregnant. I've had a pregnant wife a few times, and I know that it's not exactly a straight line. Conditions change by the day, depending on how you're feeling, and a lot of processes going on in your body. So a single test of an individual probably isn't enough information to make a decision. Taking multiple tests over the course of one pregnancy and giving some coaching on how to standardize the conditions would have been a good thing to do. This was not done in the study. A single test, one-time test, was done on the individual in the study. Then they made a decision based off of that. So if we were to break down how reliable that information could be, I'm not so sure I would consider that to be a great way to administer a study. So then when these children were of preschool age, mothers then administered a child behavioral checklist, right? It's a series of questions about their behavior that then you can assess somebody's, a child's situation, their learning ability, their behavior, where they are, if they have learning disabilities, if they have behavioral disabilities. And so the study did not go into what I think is very important, into coaching these individuals on how to ascertain the test. There are studies evaluating these types of tests, exactly that. And although they are a standard in child development, when understanding these tests, an exact study that we will also reference in the show notes show, the findings underscore continued need to enhance assessment measures and identifying early precursors. If you look at the validity of a child behavior checklist, which is used through education, the actual literature around the quality of that checklist states this. And we'll put, again, we'll link to the studies in our show notes. Psychologists may consider using a CBCL, a child behavior checklist, as a psychometrical sound narrow band and broad measurement of challenging behaviors, but should exercise caution when interpreting these types of scales for preschoolers. Their findings underscored a continued need in enhancing the measures to identifying early precursors. So in talking with some child specialists and development specialists, we had a conversation in preparing for this podcast about this exact measurement and connecting with someone who evaluates fifth graders, right? So the department in school, they evaluate fifth graders and they read the checklists and they read the evaluations from preschool through from K through five to then make decisions on how to place this child for further development, right? What classification, what help are they going to get? Are they going to be in a normal classroom? Are they going to be in a classroom where they get some assistance? How is testing going to be? It controls the fate of their life. And they noted that there is a huge variety in the quality of the information being given to them based on who's giving the test, when they give the test, how much time they have the test, how much time they know the child, and just their own preparation, their own understanding of the test, and their report is how much the individual administering the test cares about the outcome. So in looking at this study, we can note a couple problems here. The urine analysis was done at a single spot. Not the best way to measure the actual fluoride exposure of this developing child throughout their time of pregnancy. The test given to ascertain was given by an uneducated person, or not educated, but they weren't given the tools they need to understand how to give this test. There might be some bias there. We then have a study that's being put in the Journal of the American Medical Association that's then being taken to our administration to make decisions on public policy that can have a negative effect or positive effect on the individuals that make up the public. And the public's relying on these individuals to make decisions based off of sound medical information. Not an opinion, not trying to get more clicks on their Instagram, but sound medical decisions to protect everybody. I don't think this is a study that accurately can ascertain the role of fluoride in development, given the lack of information and the quality of which this study was done. The other part of it in totality is just rating the quality of the study based on the type of study it is, right? And so we'll put in our show notes the level of evidence from level 1, 2, 3, the top being randomized, controlled, double-blinded studies down the hierarchy. And we can only ascertain this type of study as one as having a lower level of evidence because of the type of studies done and how there's no blind, there's no control in it. And so it's more just ascertaining it. So I would like people to make decisions honestly. And what I mean by that is if you're just honestly scared of fluoride because you are, that's okay. That is very much okay. You have free will and you can make a decision to avoid fluoride because you're scared of it. What I caution people around is then labeling something as doing something because you're scared. It was important in medicine for me as a healthcare professional and for everyone who makes up the team of great doctors and dentists who are trying to do the right thing for patients is to use the information we have available to us to make the right decision and be willing to change as information changes. Based on the current amount of information that we have, fluoride at the levels we noted has a therapeutic benefit without having actual negative impact on IQ, on development, and on someone's health. You know, with that being said, it's kind of like we take a middle road with it, right? Because we have to, because do we have all the information on it? Maybe not. But up until this point in time, we have enough information to make what I believe is an educated decision. And if you are scared of fluoride, avoid it. Avoid it. We have some other options. So how do you avoid fluoride? We can go into it for a moment because I think it's worth it because we do have patients that are worried or have issues with their children and they want to just take everything off the table. And if you want to take everything off the table, remove fluoride then, fine. You can filter your water at home that you cook with and drink. If you want to remove all of the water at your home, have a whole house water filter. We actually have one in my home. We have a whole house reverse osmosis water filter for other reasons, not for fluoride, because just to have cleaner water. You can have a countertop water, right, where you pour the water into and filters it, keep it in the refrigerator. There's all sorts of water filters. And you can, of course, I'm drinking a natural spring water that doesn't have much fluoride in it, if any, right now.
Right.
And for the best non-fluoride toothpaste, use a nanohydroxyapatite toothpaste of 10% or higher. Risewell, we have no affiliation. Risewell and Boca are the two that we recommend most commonly. Again, you want to make sure it's 10% or higher and has to be nanohydroxyapatite. They're really nice products. I use them with my children. I alternate them. There are benefits for hydroxyapatite toothpaste for whitening, for natural desensitization of your teeth. So we do have a lot of our patients alternating with a fluoride toothpaste once a day and then a nanohydroxyapatite toothpaste once a day. I think that's just like a belt and suspenders in a sense. There's some good literature around nanohydroxyapatite. I think there needs to be more for us to really go all in as a profession, but so far it's looking good. The other thing that you can do is consider using xylitol gum or mints after eating. It's a low level xylitol. Usually it's about 0.5 grams and that's within a safe dosage again. And that has really shown to help to kill the bacteria that cause cavities and not your healthy bacteria. So the other thing you can do is if you're concerned about fluoride and you're not using it, you have to figure out your susceptibility to decay, as we mentioned many, many times. And you could also think about your acid exposure and carbohydrate exposure. So if you're exposing yourself to acid and carbs, you're feeding the bacteria that cause cavities and giving them the environment that they're comfortable in. Now, if you're doing that during a meal, the studies show it doesn't matter. Studies show that whatever you expose yourself to during a meal does not have an impact on your dental health so much. It's more the things you're doing in between the meals. So you want to avoid sipping on acidic beverages, a bunch of lemon in your water that you're sipping all morning, snacking on carbohydrates between meals. Those are the things that should detrimentally affect your oral health. So to kind of round it off, I think that you have to try to step away from the scariness of something or the emotional things at first and try to educate yourself around anything that you're doing to make a decision that's altering your health or changing your behavior so that you can try to make the most informed decision as possible. In the world we live in, it's something impossible to do. So we lean on people that we trust to make the decisions. So I think, unfortunately, right, sometimes it's hard to know where to look, where to trust, because you're getting conflicting information. Your dentist is saying one thing, this doctor that you respect online and has a national platform is saying another thing. And so who do you believe? Who do you follow? And do you just indulge the sensitive part of your emotions in the one you resonate with most? Or do you take both opinions or piece of advice and then try to educate yourself? You know, there's some really great tools right now out there. I've started playing around with Claude AI, which is what I'm finding is an incredible AI, which is able to go across databases in a very responsible manner. I think it's great. I'll just advocate that. And so even I was playing with it yesterday in preparing for this talk a little bit, just thinking about a few things, seeing what it would find, and you could have a full conversation with it. So the interesting thing about Claude AI, and I think you could use it for anything, but this is not used as a question answer, but yet it works great as a conversation. So you can type something and then you can build on it and have a full conversation with Claude. And it's really great. What I like about that is it's actually unbiased. It's pulling information from more sources than you can go through by yourself from doing an internet search and trying to make a well-informed decision at a very low time cost to you. It's very simple to do a heavy lifting of research in a short period of time by utilizing some of these tools. So when this comes out, or when you're listening to it, who knows which the front runner is, but as of right now, I like it a lot. So let us know if you have follow-up questions. Please comment on our YouTube video or wherever you're encountering this. You can email us. We're hoping to help you make informed decisions about your health. I'm not trying to dictate what you do, but trying to give you information so that you can be empowered to make the best decision for yourself. Wish you well. Let us know what questions you have. See you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us this week. I hope you found it helpful and enjoyable. Please head to our website for our show notes and more information around the topics we discussed today. Please check us out on our YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok pages for weekly updates and other interesting topics we discuss more frequently. The information provided in this podcast is for general information and educational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional advice. Accordingly, before taking any actions based on such information, we encourage you to consult with the appropriate professionals. We do not provide any medical nor health advice. You should seek the full diagnosis and treatment from your healthcare providers for any issues or conditions you may have. No doctor and patient relationship is formed. The use or reliance of any information used from this podcast is solely at your own risk. This podcast is purely for educational and informative purposes only.